Chapter 48. Celestial or Terrestrial. Follow the wayshower, and you will follow the divine idea. Turn away from the wayshower, and you turn away from the divine idea. Like turning away from the window pane, you turn away from the light. Mary Baker Eddy, 1908. Whether Reverend Vosburgh lasted only a few weeks as Mrs. Eddy's secretary, or merely departed from his lecturing temporarily to help until a permanent secretary was found, he left Chestnut Hill on February 5th, the day Adam Dickey was scheduled to begin. Snowstorms across several states, however, had delayed the trains, and Mr. Dickey was a day later than expected. Mr. Vosburgh wrote the leader the next day. Dearest leader, I have come up this morning to instruct Mr. Dickey regarding one or two points that I omitted in the note I left for him last night. I regretted extremely when I learned he did not arrive until this morning, that I did not remain with you over the night. I am grateful for the infinite patience and for the divine impatience with which you deal with your workers' shortcomings and longgoings, with which you have dealt with mine, and I am going, with renewed consecration and resolution, to work for the ideal that is given in Christ Jesus, and that your teaching is making practical, demonstrable to us, as it was to his early followers. Lovingly, faithfully, Arthur Reeves Vosburgh. Although several others seemed to know what was expected of Mr. Dickey, he had no idea when he arrived early on Thursday morning, February 6th. He had first been introduced to Calvin Fry and at breakfast met Laura Sargent, John Lathrop, and one or two others. He knew nothing about the household routine and was surprised at the reticence of the others to enlighten him. Later he understood and wrote, "I was a comparative stranger, little known to any of them. They knew I had been sent for on Mrs. Eddy's call. They also were aware that I would have to pass the customary examination through which everyone passed who was brought to Mrs. Eddy's home with the expectation of serving her. None of them knew whether I would remain after the interview long enough to unpack my valise, or whether I would remain for 3 years. Many of the people who came to our leader's home scarcely crossed the threshold, while others were interviewed by Mrs. Eddy and remained perhaps a day or two, and when she saw their services were not to be desired, they were allowed to depart and return home. John Lathrop took Mr. Dickey under his wing and began teaching him about the household routine and secretarial duties. Mr. Fry was one of the most valued household members, and Adam felt that John spoke volumes when he whispered to him, quote, "If I were you, I would cultivate Fry," end quote. Mrs. Eddy was obviously pleased with Mr. Dickey, for after much questioning during their first interview that morning, she then gave me a brief outline of some of the duties she would expect of me and asked me if I would like to come and live in her household and become a member of it and enter her service as a mental worker. I told her I would be most happy if she would employ me in any capacity whatever. In a very short time, Mr. Dickey was employed in two totally unexpected capacities. All mental workers were asked to do mental work for the leader, as Mr. Carpenter told us, after they had been there about 3 weeks. But that was in 1905. In 1908, she did not wait 3 weeks before beginning this training. and probing of the student's thought. Mr. Dickey had just returned to his room on this first morning and had not even learned that his signal was four bells when the four-bell signal rang. As soon as he had learned what it meant, he went quickly to Mrs. Eddy and was given the startling assignment of working for the leader, as well as explanations of how to do this work and why it was necessary. The second unexpected assignment was of an entirely different nature. 3 days later, on Sunday morning, February 9th, someone had occasion to go to the barn and reported that the horses had not been cared for. It was nearly noon before it was discovered that Bert, the coachman, who had been there only 1 week, had died in the night. This drastic example surely proved to Mr. Dickey that all of Mrs. Eddy's help must be working Christian Scientists. When Mrs. Eddy called her household together, she said, quote, "There is a snake in the east that only attacks when a person is asleep," end quote. She talked with them about the subtle claims of malicious mental malpractice. She also gave a good deal more thought to this occurrence. The coachman had died of heart failure, and in talking with Mr. Dickey about it later, Mrs. Eddy opened Science and Health to page 187, line 13, quote, "The valves of the heart, opening and closing for the passage of the blood, obey the mandate of mortal mind, as directly as does the hand, admittedly moved by the will," end quote. Then she impressed upon Mr. Dickey that Science and Health is like a toolbox for the metaphysician when she said, "When I turn to this book, I am like a mechanic who turns to his tools and picks up the one he wants." This reference on page 187 has a direct bearing on the case. When it occurred, I knew where it came from, for it presented itself clearly to me in thought. When Calvin Fry came into Adam Dickey's room after dinner that first Sunday afternoon and said how disappointed Mrs. Eddy was at not being able to take her drive, the following conversation ensued. Adam: "Why can't she take her drive?" Calvin: "There is nobody to drive her." Adam: "Can't you?" Calvin: "No, I never have driven a horse attached to a sleigh, and Mother is not willing for me to undertake it." Adam: "Would you like me to drive?" Calvin: "Can you do it?" Adam: "Yes, I have been accustomed to horses all my life." Mrs. Eddy questioned Mr. Dickey, with the result that he acted as her coachman for the next few days, very pleased that such a slight service meant so much to her. But before the arrival of the new coachman on Thursday, February 13th, another new member was added to the household: Martha W. Wilcox. Martha Wilcox had grown up on a farm near Ottawa, Kansas, and taught in schools near her home prior to marrying in 1895. Within 6 months of her marriage, her young husband was drowned while on a business trip, and the bereaved young widow returned to teaching. In 1899, Martha married Dwight D. Wilcox, the father of one of her young pupils, which marriage gave her two stepsons, although the older boy was soon self-supporting. When Mr. Wilcox became seriously ill in 1902, the physician advised that he be taken to Kansas City for specialized treatment, and it was there that Martha was first introduced to Christian Science. Mrs. Wilcox devoured the little book and almost immediately began devoting part of each day to healing work. Many severe cases were healed in her first years of practice, but her dear husband passed away before the end of 1904. From that time, Martha devoted her entire thought to the understanding of Christian Science. Early in February of 1908, Mrs. Wilcox received a call from James A. Neal to come to Boston to serve Mrs. Eddy at Chestnut Hill, where she arrived on Monday, February 10th. As soon as she had removed her wraps, Laura Sargent took her into Mrs. Eddy's study and introduced her, saying, quote, "This is Mrs. Wilcox from Kansas City," end quote. Mrs. Eddy said, "Good morning, Mrs. Wilcox. I felt your sweet presence in the house." During this first interview, she asked Martha what she could do and what she was willing to do. When Martha replied that she was willing to do anything Mrs. Eddy wanted, the leader replied, "My housekeeper has had to go home because of the illness of her father, and I should like to have you take her place for the time being." Martha was very young in science and not yet ready for the lessons given to the experienced mental workers each morning. But the leader began her first lesson that morning on the subject of mental malpractice. Sometimes a sense of a personality arises before your thought and leads you to believe that a personality is something outside and separate from your thought that can harm you. She showed me that the real danger was never this threatened attack from outside my thought, but that the real danger was always within my thought. Mrs. Eddy no doubt realized that at my stage of growth, I thought of creation, that is, all things, as separated into two groups, one group spiritual and the other group material, and that somehow I must get rid of the group I called material. But during this lesson, I caught my first glimpse of the fact that all right, useful things, which I had been calling, quote, "the unrighteous mammon," end quote, were mental and represented spiritual ideas. When Mrs. Eddy had finished this first lesson, she said, "Now take your young child down into Egypt and let it grow up until it is strong enough to stand alone." And Martha did just that, pondered it silently. Years later, she could summarize this first lesson briefly. 1. To handle mental malpractice within my own consciousness. And 2. There are not two groups of creation, just one. Following the lesson, Mrs. Eddy said, "I should like to have you make a pudding for my dinner today, an apple Betty pudding. No one seems to get pudding to taste as it used to taste when I lived at Lynn." Martha did glimpse the importance of mental work for everything, even pudding, and she did her best. However, she was almost overwhelmed with all she had learned in less than half a day. After dinner, Mrs. Eddy said to her maid, "Tell Martha that the pudding was very good, but no better than Mrs. Scott made yesterday," which made Martha realize that everyone in the house was being trained individually. What Mr. Dickey had at first thought was a crude system of bell ringing in Mrs. Eddy's home soon appeared to him as a very effective, ingenious institution, which he thought Calvin Fry must have improvised. Different numbers of bells rang in different areas of the house, depending upon which student was being summoned. He had not been in the household long when he heard the bells ringing all over the house one morning, and before long Mr. Fry opened his door and said, "That means everybody." When all the mental workers had presented themselves in her study, Mrs. Eddy opened her Bible and read to them. James 1:21-25. "Wherefore, lay apart all filthiness and superfluity of naughtiness, and receive with meekness the engrafted word, which is able to save your souls. But be ye doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass. For he beholdeth himself, and goeth his way, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was. But whoso looketh into the perfect law of liberty, and continueth therein, he being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his deed." When Mrs. Eddy expounded this passage to them, Mr. Dickey saw his own true being more clearly than he had ever seen it before. After inspiring them, she exhorted them to greater efforts with this reprimand: "You are not doing your work as you should, and I shall not instruct you further until you have demonstrated something more of what has been taught. It would be a poor teacher that would take students up into the higher branches of mathematics before they had proved addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. Therefore, until you demonstrate in better fashion what you have already been taught, I shall teach you no more." The leader was a natural teacher, teaching every minute of every day in all she said and did. But all of her students needed nudging most of the time to force them toward spiritual accomplishment. Further instruction for all the field was published in the Sentinel of February 15th. A new bylaw. Article 28. Now Article 23. Requirements for organizing branch churches, Section 8. A branch church of the First Church of Christ Scientist, Boston, Mass., shall not be organized with less than 16 loyal Christian Scientists, 4 of whom are members of the Mother Church. This membership shall include at least one active practitioner, whose card is published in the list of practitioners in the Christian Science Journal. About this same time, and when she had been at Chestnut Hill but a short time, Mrs. Wilcox was called by Mrs. Eddy to be her personal maid for a month. In the first few days, Martha learned a great lesson watching Mrs. Eddy work. She wrote almost constantly for 3 days. She consulted the dictionary, the grammar, studied synonyms and antonyms, and when she had finished, she had 2 lines to add to Science and Health. I marveled at her perseverance. But she had worked out a scientific statement for Christian Science students that would stand through the ages. This statement, occasioned by the sudden fatal attack on her coachman, was introduced as follows in the Sentinel of February 29th. Take notice. I request the Christian Scientists universally to read the paragraph beginning at line 30 on page 442 in the edition of Science and Health, which will be issued February 29th. I consider the information there given to be of great importance at this stage of the workings of animal magnetism, and it will greatly aid the students in their individual experiences. Mary Baker G. Eddy. The paragraph of two lines plus one word added to page 442 in the February 29th, 1908 edition of Science and Health read, quote, "Christian scientists, be a law to yourselves that mental malpractice can harm you neither when asleep nor when awake," end quote. Numerous letters of appreciation for this instruction were published in the Sentinel. One student correlated this latest edition with the passage in Miscellaneous Writings, page 258, lines 12 to 15. Quote, "In the spiritual genesis of creation, all law was vested in the lawgiver, who was a law to himself. In divine science, God is one and all, and governing himself, he governs the universe." End quote. Another notice in the February 29th Sentinel stated that the new publishing house building was, quote, "being pushed as rapidly as possible," end quote, and asked the branch churches to help keep the treasurer supplied with necessary funds. Martha Wilcox was working as diligently as she knew how. With no training in such work, the leader had given her 7 finely written pages of things to be done, which, quote, "necessitated continuity of action without false moves or forgetting," end quote. Another student was very happy to receive the letter Mrs. Eddy wrote to him on February 20th, telling him to come to Chestnut Hill for 4 weeks. "Do not fail to come, and then if you and God and I think best, you can arrange perhaps to remain here." So Irving C. Tomlinson returned to Mrs. Eddy's household about the same time that John Lathrop returned to his work in New York City. After the 4-week trial, Mr. Tomlinson continued at Chestnut Hill and remained with Mrs. Eddy through 1910. The remodeling that Mrs. Eddy wanted for her rooms necessitated her moving temporarily to Miss Eveleth's rooms on the 3rd floor. The architect said it was impossible to install a second elevator where Mrs. Eddy wanted it, but she insisted, and it was done along with reducing the size of the rooms in her apartment and lowering the windows for a better view. A day shift and a night shift of workmen helped to expedite the project, but also made the housekeeping quite difficult. It was the 2nd week in March when Mr. Dickey joyfully carried the news up to Mrs. Eddy that she could return to her own apartment on the following Saturday, which pleased her greatly. There was still a good deal to be done, and in addition to the workmen, all the household worked eagerly to complete the project. Following her drive on Saturday, March 14th, she moved back into her own suite of rooms. Everything was finished except her pink parlor, and the work on that continued. A few days later, carpet layers from Boston were scheduled to lay the carpet in her pink parlor while she was out on her daily drive, but the room was not ready for them. The floor was covered with fresh plaster, etc. John Salcho, who usually took care of such jobs, was away that morning, and Martha Wilcox said, "So I cleaned the floor and the carpet paper and laid it and had the room ready for the men to lay the carpet. But I myself was a sight to behold. The men were through and gone by the time the carriage returned, and I had a few minutes to freshen myself. Martha was barely presentable when Laura Sargent came to her and said, "Martha, Mother wants you." When I entered, the mental workers were all standing about the room. I went to her and said, "What do you want, Mother?" With tears rolling down her cheeks, she replied, "I have been praying for God to send someone who will stand no matter what comes up, and He has told me to call you. Now, come in every day with the mental workers and have your lessons and do your mental work." The leader had also discovered in Mr. Dickey a most desirable quality that few other than her darling Augusta had, and that was obedience. Mr. Dickey had heard before coming to Chestnut Hill that the leader had great difficulty in finding workers who would follow her orders implicitly, and he laid the obligation upon himself before he began in Mrs. A's employ of absolute obedience without questioning. It did not take Mrs. Eddy long to discover this quality of obedience in my thought, and she at once evidenced a pleasure in having me do things for her, so that when she moved into her new room and settled it, I was privileged to stand at her hand and place everything where she wished it. She herself named the spot on the mantel where each ornament should rest, while I, overjoyed at this rare privilege, moved things back and forth at her command until everything was placed as she desired it. Mrs. Eddy also supervised the hanging of all the pictures in the house, and most especially those in her study and bedroom. On the day Mr. Dickey helped her with this, he particularly noted a remarkably well-executed painting entitled "The Return from the Crucifixion." It showed the beloved disciple ascending the steps of his home, sustaining the drooping form of the Mother of Jesus. The faces of the group, with the exception of Jesus's mother, were anxiously turned toward a hill beyond the walls of Jerusalem, where silhouetted against the sky appeared the three crosses, which stood as mute witnesses of the dreadful day's experience. A very few minutes after Mr. Dickey had completed the picture hanging and returned to his room, he was recalled to Mrs. Eddy's study. Pointing with one hand to the picture just described and placing the other on her breast, she said in a voice deep and earnest in its subdued tones, "Mr. Dickey, I think you had better remove that picture. It suggests too much for me. Won't you kindly put another in its place?" This I did. Another type of remodeling was going on at this time. William Lyman Johnson had made an interesting discovery in pursuing his study of heraldry and related topics. He wrote Mrs. Eddy soon after she had moved to Chestnut Hill that the crown in the Christian Science seal was a ducal coronet with strawberry leaves, whereas he felt that it should be the Christian's crown of five stars. Many times the leader had bowed to man's opinion, and she did so once again. On February 14th, Adam Dickey returned the five new seal designs, on one of which Mrs. Eddy had written, quote, "Eddy," end quote, to William D. McCracken, who had replaced Allison V. Stewart on the Board of Trustees. The letter from Dickey to McCracken, enclosed with the seal designs, may indicate that Mrs. Eddy did not select the new design that Mr. McCracken had recommended. "In reply to your letter to our leader, under date of February 13th, enclosing new designs to be used on Christian Science books, I have to report that she has selected the enclosed detached design which bears her signature. I also enclose the unapproved designs. The letter Mr. Dickey wrote to Archibald McClellan on March 10th is probably in reference to the new crown in the new seal design. I enclose herewith Mr. William Lyman Johnson's letter to our leader, which explains itself. It seems that she wishes the matter referred to you, and I have written Mr. Johnson to that effect, and asking him to take the matter up with you. The leader did have an interview with Mr. McClellan and Stephen A. Chase at Chestnut Hill on March 16th, but that could have been in relation to the new building for the Publishing Society, which was under construction and closely related to another project she had in mind, but had not yet voiced. God had spoken to her one day when she opened her Bible to Isaiah 62. Go through the gates. Prepare ye the way of the people. Cast up the highway. Gather out the stones. Lift up a standard for the people. A letter from the trustees of the Publishing Society, dated March 18th, stated, Beloved leader and teacher, knowing the kindly interest which you take in the progressive work of the Christian Science Publishing Society, I take pleasure in behalf of the trustees in sending you a copy of the new cover for the Christian Science Journal. It will appear with the April number. We have bound this cover over the March number, in this instance, that you might have a clearer impression of the appearance of the new cover. We hope that it will be considered by you as an improvement. The new seal is being used in connection with this cover, showing a celestial crown, or a Christian's crown, combined with the cross. Whenever a student accomplished anything by turning to mind to guide him, Mrs. Eddy was lavish in her praise and appreciation, even if the accomplishment seemed insignificant. Mr. Carpenter said, Mrs. Eddy was most punctilious in sending letters of appreciation for services performed. She took her valuable time that was needed in other directions and sent letters to those of her students who performed faithful service. She never failed to express appreciation for work that was done by demonstration. On one occasion, when I made a demonstration for her in a minor matter, it seemed strange to have Mrs. Eddy so appreciative about it, but she thereby indicated how little demonstration she received, so that when one did work according to divine mind, her appreciation seemed almost extravagant. Contrariwise, when a student's efforts were directed by the human mind, and he did not turn to mind, God, for guidance, which was far more often the case, there was little or no appreciation, and sometimes criticism or rebuke from the leader. Knowing this causes one to ponder the response to the trustees regarding the new seal. Did she consider this, quote, progressive work of the Christian Science Publishing Society, end quote, as an improvement? Or did she submit to man's idea of a, quote, celestial crown, end quote, as she had to her mansion in Brookline? Mr. Dickey wrote to Mr. McCracken the next day, March 19th. In reply to your letter of the 18th last, addressed to our leader, accompanied by a copy of the new cover for the Christian Science Journal. Mrs. Eddy was busily engaged on another matter when I presented your book, and without making any special comment, she requested me to ask the trustees to, quote, keep on the outside of our periodicals the emblem of the celestial and not the terrestrial. End quote. I take it by this that the new design was acceptable to our leader, and that you may proceed with that understanding. Many a student in Mrs. Eddy's household was offended when his human efforts were criticized, or in his eyes unappreciated. Mayhap Mr. McCracken was offended by the leader's seeming indifference to their, quote, celestial crown improvement, end quote. For 2 or 3 weeks later, he tendered his resignation with what Mackenzie and Hatton, the other trustees, felt was insufficient reason, and a few months later left Boston and removed to Switzerland. Only 3 months earlier, Mr. McCracken had written to, quote, beloved leader and teacher, end quote, let me, as the first act of my trusteeship, thank you for this added mark of your confidence. I welcome the duties of this new office as a further opportunity of serving God and mankind by helping to disseminate your teachings over the broad, receptive earth. With renewed expression of my profound gratitude, I have the honor of signing myself, your faithful follower. This Publishing Society trustee was an example of just how receptive, quote, the broad receptive earth, end quote, was to Mrs. Eddy's teachings. If this, quote, faithful follower, end quote, felt that his ideas, quote, of serving God and mankind, end quote, were better than Mrs. Eddy's, he was not the first one. There were many students who had caused Mrs. Eddy to say, quote, they think they can run things just as well and a little better than I can, end quote. Jesus had answered the disciples' question, who is greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Matthew 18, verses 3 and 4. Except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. The mother spent all her years in teaching her children how to become as little children. But lessons in humility are difficult for all capable people, and doubly so for the accomplished and talented individual who needs it most of all. At one time, Mrs. Eddy said, the human sense of leadership creates a poison, the virus of which is more deadly than the bite of the moccasin, and from which the victim cannot heal himself or be healed, but must suffer. This is the sin against the Holy Ghost, because it sets up a mind and mental activity separate from God and His idea. In other words, substitutes itself and its sense for principle and its reflection, and thereby becomes a belief of another God and reflection, though sensual instead of spiritual. All error. Alfred Farlow had written the leader an interesting letter on March 9th regarding another issue on which she had bowed to the claims of men. Dear teacher, you remember that a few years ago critics affirmed that your first husband, George W. Glover, was not entitled to be called colonel, and that some of the North Carolina students claimed to have discovered that he could properly be called major, but not colonel. During the past winter, I took up that question again, and I have learned upon good authority that Mr. Glover's position as a member of the governor's staff made him a member of the staff militia, the governor of the state being commander-in-chief of the state militia, and that it was a custom all over the South to apply the title colonel to one who had occupied that position. Thus, you may note that you were correct in referring to your husband as Colonel George W. Glover, and in saying that he was sometimes called Colonel, and at other times called Captain. Most likely Mrs. Eddy had never doubted that she was correct, but she had acquiesced to the demands of men. When Gilbert Carpenter had heard early in February that Mrs. Eddy was in need of a coachman, he had recommended one of his patients who had been a minister, Mr. Adolph Stevenson. Mr. Stevenson came to Chestnut Hill on February 13th and served Mrs. Eddy well at her new house in Newton. But this house was not like her Pleasant View, which she loved so dearly. All of the world and most of her students felt that her spacious new home was a great step in advancement. Henrietta Schonfrau may have recorded the leader's words in her heart on the day that she had told her if she ever left Pleasant View, it would be to be delivered up to her enemies. But probably only Mrs. Eddy had any idea what that meant. Mr. Stevenson may have suggested a beautification project for her new estate, for she wrote him a letter on March 17th, part of which said, "I hereby tell you that no garden or flowers shall be cultivated on my place. Make no road for one to see such things on this place. The road to heaven is not one of flowers, but it is straight and narrow. It is bearing the cross and turning away from things that lure the material senses, denying them and finding all in spirit, in God, in good, and doing good." Mrs. Eddy wrote letters to all of her employees, and she wrote to Mr. Stevenson again on March 19th. "My dear Mr. Stevenson, if you treat either of our horses for the fear of an automobile, it will help them just as it heals the sick, by destroying their fear. Horses are nearly as receptive of the effect from Christian Science treatment as human beings are. In haste, affectionately, M.B.G. Eddy." As always, her interest extended to everyone and everything. But for quite a long time, ever since God had spoken to her through Isaiah 62, verse 10, she had been considering another major undertaking, which would spread around the world. She had even decided upon a name for this new project, though she had not yet breathed one word of it to anyone. But the mind that was unfolding this new step in her thought was also nudging the receptive thought of others. On March 12th, she received a letter from one of her followers in Boston, John L. Wright, deploring the disappearance of the, quote, "stable, sane, patriotic newspaper," end quote, and outlining a great many of the features she had been considering as desirable in a daily newspaper, with one important exception. His letter stated, "I am not thinking of a daily official Christian Science paper, or one containing in its title the words Christian Science." That was exactly what the leader was thinking of, and she wrote on the back of Mr. Wright's letter, "Beloved student, I have had this newspaper scheme in my thought for quite a while, and herein send my name for our daily newspaper, the Christian Science Monitor. This title only classifies the paper, and it should have departments for what else is requisite." There is no record that this response was ever sent to Mr. Wright, but in a very few months, he was one of the newspaper men employed to bring forth the Christian Science Monitor, and he was its first city editor.